Okay, we are there at 4 o'clock, just past, so I think we better get going. And this week we are going to mostly look at the Reformation. We're moving through in time. But before we do that, I want to talk about something that's quite interesting, another example of our tangled history, and that's conversion in both directions, because it happened during the Middle Ages. Not always well, by no means equally. We'll also pick up on this later because in next week's session we will be looking, we'll be featuring quite an important convert from Judaism to Christianity, who had quite a major role to play. But this does pop up every now and then. And of course, when somebody moves from one side to the other side, they bring their cultural baggage with them. Even if they change their religion, they can't erase what they already know. And that has interesting knock-on effects. I want to just consider some examples of that. Now, the much more common direction was people converting from Judaism to Christianity. And that's not really surprising, given the fact that there was a lot of pressure to do so, that Christians in these societies we're talking about, with the majority, that Jews were in a secondary position, the second-class citizens were barred from certain professions, often couldn't own land, often could not rise up to important positions, because often you had to be in the church for that, couldn't join guilds of craftsmen in many, many cases. It did vary a bit. It depended where you were. But generally, Jews were in a disadvantaged position. And for some people, to just take that step and cross that boundary might be worth it if they were ambitious, if they had particular pressure applied to them. It did mean, of course, that the Jewish community cast you out and you might lose friends and relations. But some people did take that step. And surprisingly, it wasn't always just uneducated people. There were quite a few rabbis who converted. Maybe it was. Sometimes they were convinced, or for principally theological reasons or religious reasons. It's very difficult to know. We don't have many diaries, or I don't think we have any diaries, or very few first-person accounts. So a lot of this is guessing. There were forced conversions at different times and different places in the Middle Ages, in Christian societies. For instance, in the 14th century, the Archbishop of Écija in Spain, Ferrand Martinez, incited violence against Jews that reached a peak in 1391, and there were violent attacks on Jewish communities right the way across Spain. Several thousand Jews died, and many other thousands converted to Christianity, and really, you can't blame them. It was very, very frightening indeed. They feared for their lives. Some estimates put that number at over 100,000 Jews converting to Christianity. This is the 1391 incidents. That's way before 1492. So yes, it did happen. Some of those people would then have reverted once they felt it was safe, but some people didn't. Once they had converted, however, Jews were legally not allowed to revert to Judaism, and they were at risk of trial by the Inquisition, a branch of the church, if they were thought to be continuing to practice Judaism secretly. And I think we might have mentioned this before. Sometimes people think that the Inquisition went for Jews. No, it went for Jews who had converted. And it went for descendants of Jews who had converted. And it went for Christians who were suspected of Judaizing, of carrying out Jewish practices. It did not ever have anything to do or have any legal authority over Jews who were Jews. So the Inquisition was specifically for a certain segment of the Jewish, or possibly the ex-Jewish community. And in Spain in particular, there were, as we know, a lot of Jews who maintained their religion in secret at considerable risk, especially after 1492, when there was another wave of forced conversion. You either had to get out or convert. And I think something like a third of Spanish Jews chose to remain. Therefore, they chose to convert, insincerely, one imagines, in those cases. But of course, it's very hard to maintain a religion in secret, and sometimes their children became very true believers, or sometimes their grandchildren became very true believers, and sometimes they didn't, and this went down the centuries. And I'm sure you've all seen or heard various news items or read articles about communities such as the community of Belmonte in Portugal, where a secret, hidden Jewish identity was kept right up to the middle of the 20th century. And I gather that still in the southern part of the United States, people who come up from South America occasionally turn up on the doorsteps of various shuls saying, my ancestors have been Jewish. You know, they were converted back in the 16th century, and we've been Jewish ever since, but we've had to hide it, and I want to come out and be Jewish. So it still does actually happen that people turn up from these families. And of course, probably the majority by this stage, no, they've all sort of got assimilated into the general Christian population. Spain was an unusual case because there they had this sort of crazy proto-racist ideology of limpieza de sangre, the purity of blood. So they were very concerned down the generations. In many other societies, when a Jew converted, their kids were usually not concealing sort of secret Judaism. So it's particularly a Spanish and Portuguese phenomenon. I don't know there were so many examples anywhere else. In other places, sometimes Jews preferred to be martyred, as in the Crusades. They didn't always, but sometimes there were quite a lot of Jews who were convinced and who went over voluntarily and might marry non-Jews or might persuade the rest of their family. And those Jews did not produce lines of descendants who were living a double life. And I see Sylvia said, you met somebody in New Mexico who came to tell your tour group about her experiences. She converted back to Judaism, but her family thought she was crazy. Yes. Yeah, I think it's not an unusual story. I've been to a couple of sessions at Limud about this phenomenon, and once or twice I've met somebody who said, we can't prove it, but we're all sure our ancestors were Jewish. And a couple of people who actually are currently candidates for conversion and are pretty sure they have this past, but just didn't have the documentation, which by the nature of things would be pretty unlikely to have. So in the Spanish-Portuguese case, of course, some of these secret Jews, the old word used to be Marranos, but it means pigs and it's not very nice. So people don't use Marrano much anymore. They do use the word converso still. So some of later generations actually left Spain, and they resumed their Jewish identity either in the Ottoman Empire, which was Muslim but didn't mind Jews coming out as Jews, or later on the 16th century, they often went to Amsterdam, where there was a policy of religious toleration, which we'll talk about a bit later when we discuss the Reformation. And there they came out as Jews, sometimes not right away. They waited a bit. I have ancestors who came from Portugal via Amsterdam, and I imagine that is exactly what they did probably. And yes, so that's a sort of a live part of that culture of conversion. And there have been studies done on books and theological thought of these ex-Spanish Portuguese communities and how their enforced education or life as Christians on the surface actually influenced their thought. In many of these communities, Esther was, rather appropriately, was a very very potent figure because they felt that she too had concealed her Judaism because she'd been forced to do so and only came out with it later. So they had a special relationship with the Book of Esther and the Festival of Purim. And yes, there are interesting knock-on effects when somebody comes from a long line of people who've been doing this, and one presumes that every generation they lost more and more information about how to be Jewish. And while all of them going through a Christian education system, they sometimes, when they did return to Judaism, import some of the ideas of Christianity with them, unconsciously. But it might have shaped the way they understood certain elements of, you could say, mainstream Judaism. So that's quite interesting. I've put the link in twice, but I'll put in there again. So there's the link to source sheets again. Okay. So not all conversion was by force. We said there were quite a few individual Jews who decided to convert, apparently voluntarily. Though the question is, what does voluntarily mean if you're living as a rather degraded second citizen? You know, there is pressure there of some sort. So, and there was always the threat of violence. There was the threat of fear. They went up or down. Of course, you got taxed much more heavily, and of course, you weren't secure. So when we say that some Jews converted voluntarily, well, it was not a level playing field ever. And that is absolutely sure. But there were some people who apparently of their own will did cross that boundary, particularly in Germany. Some of them, by no means all, were quite active in accusing their former co-religionists of all sorts of crimes, including child sacrifice. And they sometimes set up as experts on Judaism and published libelous books that said quite hostile material. One very famous person we'll talk about next week, Johannes Pfefferkorn, actually one of the most famous converts from this time, did so, and there were others too. And it seems to be they were trying to consolidate their own position by ratting on their former co-religionists or making up stories about them. It was very clear to everyone that even if you had converted to Christianity, you were still Jewish. And people would refer to these people who were now meant to be good Christians as Jews still. And they never quite managed to shake off the prejudice associated with being Jewish, even if they did accept Christianity. So it was a bit damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I imagine a lot of the pretty nasty, fairly anti-Semitic stuff produced by this particular class of convert was the result of continuing insecurity and trying desperately to be accepted and to disassociate yourself from your former community so that you would finally be integrated in the Christian community. And rather tragically for them, that never really happened. They were known as Jews just permanently. Their kids sometimes got away with it. So it's also not clear whether some people didn't convert because they had appalling relationships within the Jewish community and wanted to get their revenge back on people who they'd fallen out with. And that seems to be the motive in some cases. So it's very difficult to know exactly what was going on because we don't have enough information. Sometimes they were quite high up people. So Victor of Carbon, who lived 1422 to 1515, was a former rabbi. And he became a priest. That was something that was quite common. If you had been a rabbi, you might very well go into the church and have quite a glittering career. There were bishops who had been Jewish originally. We'll talk about them in a moment. So Victor of Carbon wrote books attacking Judaism and actually was active in getting Jews expelled from several towns quite near Cologne. Now, that wasn't just in Germany. An early example from Spain this time is Solomon Halevi, who converted to Christianity after the pogroms in 1391. And he took the name Pablo de Santa Maria. He's also known as Paul of Burgos. And he'd been a very prominent Jewish scholar, and he later became Archbishop of Burgos. So, you know, that was quite a stellar career. If you were bright enough and if you came with enough resources, you might actually do quite well. He did continue to correspond with Jewish scholars, but he also put a lot of effort into trying to make them convert as well, sometimes successfully. And some of these converts did write accounts of their conversion. They were often circulated to Jewish communities to try and persuade other people to convert as well. And in doing so, they often adapted Jewish ideas and sources to a Christian context. So they used Jewish weapons to try and fight against Judaism. And again, they were also known to do that. And again, you can see this sort of bridging across the divide. You move over to the Christian side, but then you use Talmudic arguments to try and persuade your fellow Jews to convert along with you. So again, we've got this back and forth, which is quite interesting. And so you could call it channel communication in some way, maybe not our ideal one. I see that Susanna's written, weren't some of the Jewish priests also cryptid Jews and taught other Christian Jews? Not that I know of, but it's possible. I think everyone reached the level of priest had sort of engaged with Christianity. Most of the cryptid Jews I know about were not priests. They were just people sort of trying to get away with it, basically. Weren't most rabbis married? So how did they become priests? They often left their wives in the Jewish community. Very often the wives wouldn't go when they converted. In fact, there are a lot of response about what do? This person's converted. How can we make them give their wife a get? So that was quite a recurrent problem. Yeah. And it could well be actually on the Christian side that they just said, well, you know, you're like a new, you're a new convert. Your Jewish marriage doesn't count at all. So I imagine that might not have been an obstacle on the Christian side. One of them, terrible obstacle for the wife on the Jewish side, however, because even if converted, you would still need a get to be able to remarry. And that was a problem. So we said that some of these converts had very high levels of Jewish education. And they existed rather uneasily alongside the Christians of the time who were getting interested in Judaism and learning Hebrew. And this was roughly the same time, right about the time of the sort of before and up to the Reformation. We'll talk about them in another session. But there was a phenomenon of Christian scholars who wanted to be able to read the Bible in the original languages and who thereupon, having learned some Hebrew, very often from Jews, they often had quite cooperative relations, would explore Jewish literature further and became experts. And we're going to talk about a prime example of that next week. So again, you've got sort of communication here as well. The Jewish converts to Christianity existed somewhat uneasily alongside these new Christian experts or semi-experts very often on Judaism. The converts often taught Hebrew to their new Christian fellows. So again, we have another example of education or Jewish influence going across that boundary. The Christian Hebraists, as they're known, were often a lot less critical of Jewish traditional rabbinic literature than the new converts were, who tended to attack it. Of course, they didn't have anything to prove in terms of their identity and allegiance, and the converts did. Jews for Jesus is a modern phenomenon. That's only been going, by the way, since the middle of the 20th century. It's basically a front for evangelical churches. Not many members of Jews for Jesus are actually Jewish. And they pass the Jews, they do manage to convert, they pass them along to regular churches. So that was not a thing then. Okay, so we'll turn to some rare but not unique examples of people who went the other way and converted from Christianity to Judaism. And quite naturally, there are far, far fewer of them, because apostatizing from Christianity could carry the death penalty if you were caught. So, you know, it was a bit of a discourager, and there were never as many going the other way for obvious reasons. But there were some, which really actually testifies to their courage, because, you know, what a risky thing to do. One of the earliest we know of was a Frankish deacon called Bodo. And in the year 838, he converted to Judaism. He ran away from the court of the Frankish king, Louis the Pious, which was in Aachen, and he settled in Muslim Spain because it was safer there. It was, you know, not such a difficult proposition. And while there, he had a big theological debate with Alvaro of Cordoba, who was a Jewish convert to Christianity. And we actually still have some of the letters they exchanged. So you had the Christian convert to Judaism arguing with the Jewish convert to Christianity, each trying to prove that the other was wrong, which I think must be a quite unusual situation. I don't know where you can find those letters. I'd love to read them, actually. That would be quite amazing. I think it would be good for a play, wouldn't it? It would be a wonderful thing. There was another example, another cleric, and this is actually quite typical. It's often clergymen who convert to Judaism. I would imagine because they read the Old Testament, they get convinced that, you know, Jesus is not what he says he is. So, you know, I want to live in this authentic way that I see in my Old Testament. And that's why they start getting interested. So I think that's probably why it's mostly Christian clergymen who are converting. Yeah. So another one is this chap, Wesselinus. He had been a servant of the high up servant of the Duke of Carinthia, you know, some form of priest in minor orders at least. And he converted to Judaism in the year about 1005, 1006, somewhere around there. And he went off to the Jewish community of Mainz and settled there. And rather daringly, or perhaps foolishly, he wrote several books attacking Christianity. And in 1012, Henry II, the Holy Roman Emperor, expelled Jews from the city of Mainz for a while, probably as a reaction. So maybe that was not the cleverest thing to do. But the best known example is, some of you may have heard of them, is Obadiah or Ovadiah the proselyte of Ovadiah Hager. And we know quite a bit about his story, and I'll tell you why. In about 1102, he converted to Judaism. He came from southern Italy. He was born about 1070, so he must have been about 32 when he converted, something like that. And he took the name Obadiah. Remarkably, we have several documents he wrote, some of which have survived in the Carrigonesa. And I'm hoping you know a little bit about the Carrigonesa, which is this treasure house of Jewish documents, and actually not including some non-Jewish documents that over a millennia or millennium and a half, really, were gathered in the Geniza of this the Ben Ezra synagogue in Cairo, and were discovered in the 19th century. And several of them ended up in different places around the world, but the bulk of it was bought for the University Library of Cambridge, and that's where the bulk of the Geniza is today. Solomon Schechter, who then later on went to the States and was very important in conservative Judaism, was the mover there. He got Cambridge to agree to buy it. And when I was studying there, actually, I used to see bits of the Geniza, and the head of the Geniza project was a member of the shul. He used to come in occasionally on a Shabbat morning going, "We just found another letter by Rambam." You know, it was very exciting. They were doing all the preserving and the cataloguing at that stage, which I think think we moved on to the next stage now. They've digitized a lot of it. So we have documents written by Obadiah, the proselyte, and I can actually show you a picture of this, which is rather fun. Where are we? There we are. Yes, so this is one of the bits of his memoir. So very helpfully for us, he wrote this memoir. You can see this is a rather fragmentary bit. It was a 7-page long document. I'm not sure how well this particular copy is actually preserved, but there turn out to be 14 fragments of it in various places. They're not all in Cambridge. And from this, we learn that after he converted, he went off to Constantinople. And from then he went to Iraq. And when he was finished writing his memoir, he was on the way to Egypt, where he presumably actually wrote, maybe copied the whole memoir out, because that's where it was found. And he seems to be at least partly inspired by the story of an earlier convert who was a bishop, Bishop Andreas of Bari, who died in 1078, so shortly after Obadiah was born. And he'd also converted to Judaism and moved to Constantinople, which is obviously the thing to do, and on to Iraq. Again, it may have been that his studies of the Old Testament when he was a priest, because Obadiah had been a priest, were what moved him to convert. And the Cairo Geniza also yielded up a recommendation letter for him by a Rabbi Baruch of Aleppo, who said, you know, this is a convert in good standing, please look after him. And he carried that around on his travels and would have used it to introduce himself to Jewish communities so they knew he was who he said he was. Now, of course, as a priest, he'd learned to write and read, and also to notate music in the system of the time. And he was using a system that was common in southern Italy in the medieval period. And thanks to Obadiah the proselyte, we have the only example of written notation of Jewish music before the modern period. And it's a setting of a piyut, a liturgical poem in honor of Moshe. And here it is. I know it doesn't look like music, but this is his system, these sort of little bits and pieces. And because of that, we can actually reconstruct what at least one piyut in medieval Europe sounded like. And you can actually hear a recording of it. This is the Hebrew University has got a little recording of it, and you can hear what it sounded like. So that's quite amazing. I think he also did some notating of actual Torah laning, which doesn't sound like anything we do today. So either it's just evolved over time and we're unaware of it, or else they were doing something a little bit odd in southern Italy, or maybe in Constantinople in his time. It's difficult to know. So that's a very interesting example of cross-communal exchange of knowledge. You have a priest using his knowledge of notation of music, which is exclusive to the Christian community at this time. Nobody else is notating music, to notate Jewish music. And I think that's such a lovely and amazing, amazing example. So that really is a lot of fun. Okay, so we're going to move on from that example of a tangled history, and we're going to look at the Reformation, because the Reformation is crucial in the development of certain Western Christianity, and also affected Jews, as we'll see. And it began as a movement to reform abuses in the Catholic Church, which there were many. Many Christians were very upset about the state of the church. Offices in the church were being sold for money. Though priests weren't technically allowed to marry, everyone knew that some of them had concubines, and various popes promoted various, they were called nephews. They weren't actually nephews, to various high positions as well. So you can imagine that people who knew about that were pretty cross about the whole thing. So the false doctrines came up, things that have been added since the time of the New Testament, incorrect practices of which there was no record in the New Testament, bothered some people absolutely terribly. And one of the things that particularly annoyed people was the sale of indulgences. And indulgences were based on the idea that the church had the power to grant forgiveness of sins, which you can see again in the sacrament of confession in the Catholic Church. And originally, that was just, you know, the priest gave absolution of sin to a sinner who had confessed and had often had to perform a penance, like going to a site of pilgrimage or reciting certain prayers. But by the time the Reformation started, you could buy indulgences. So if you had enough cash, it was a huge cash cow for the Catholic Church. And the printing technology that had just been invented by Gutenberg had enabled printing of indulgences. So you can imagine it was very, very a good system for collecting money. And people were absolutely outraged by this, you know, from Christians. You know, the idea that you could pay to have your sins taken away was absolutely disgusting. There was a lot of corruption among the clergy. Some clergymen held several positions and didn't actually do anything for certain congregations. Sometimes they didn't live in the places they were meant to be living in to serve the local population. You could buy positions in the church, and protectia, in the Israeli sense, was a big thing. You could, you know, pull your strings and get appointed to a lucrative job somewhere or other for which you didn't have to do very much and just rake the money in. And then there were, as you said, these doctrines and beliefs that didn't actually have any New Testament or biblical warrant. For instance, the concept of purgatory, a place where you go to pay off your sins after death before you can be admitted to heaven. Various ideas about purgatory also included the idea that small babies who died without being christened would end up in purgatory, or maybe virtuous heathens who weren't Christian would end up in purgatory. But there's no mention of purgatory in the New Testament. So many people were saying, well, you know, who made up purgatory? We don't see any evidence in our Bible at all for this. And the authority of the Pope, actually, as the supreme primate, is nowhere at all in the New Testament. People are a bit cross about that. The celibacy of the clergy is quite a late thing and really wasn't imposed in Europe till about the 8th century. Still, in some of the Orthodox churches, priests can be married. So Greek Orthodox priests are often married. Monks aren't, but priests are. So that was a late introduction. Devotion to Mary, the mother of Jesus, and the promotion of the worship or the cult of the saints. Again, there's nothing about it in the New Testament. So there's, the people were a bit cross about this. Well, as printing also brought copies of the Bible within more people's reach, and literacy starts increasing because, you know, now there are books that you can afford to buy and read. And people are just going, well, I can't find where this is. You know, my holy text doesn't tell me about this. And this, it increased and increased and increased this feeling. People got pretty upset, as you can imagine. So there was a lot of hatred for the clergy, a lot of despising of the clergy, and a lot of people hoping for reform. And probably the main movers here were people's genuine spiritual feelings that their church was corrupt. I mean, I think some of us have this occasionally when we look at rabbis who disgrace themselves, and we go, you know, how on earth can this person do that? And people felt that. They felt outraged that their religion was being made a travesty of and not being represented. The church had got more and more bureaucratized, more formal, not surprising. You know, we're talking 16th century since it was founded. It had its own legal system called canon law. It had a dogmatic theology. It was focused on the sacraments, only two of which are mentioned in the New Testament. The sacraments could only be administered by priests by this point. And the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215 had established the doctrine that you could only be saved, you could only, you know, live after death and be absolved of your sins through good works like fasting and chastity and abstinence and asceticism, which meant that a lot of people felt they weren't going to be saved as well. So in the middle of all this ferment, the very famous Martin Luther arose. He was born in 1483 and he died in 1546, but things get going in 1517. He was a monk. He was a professor at the University of Wittenberg. And in 1517, very famously, he nailed his 95 theses to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg and let loose the Reformation. Now, these were 95 propositions that condemned and challenged the practice of selling indulgences, and implicitly they attacked the Pope and the Church's claim to be authorities who could award or refuse salvation to Christians at their will. Now, Luther himself had already had a crisis of faith. He was weighed down by a terrible sense of sin and doom, and this he had overcome. It sounds also as if it was sort of depressive in nature. He'd opened his Bible at random and he'd read a verse in the New Testament epistle to the Romans that says, "For the justice of God is revealed from faith to faith, in that it is written, for the just shall live by faith." He suddenly had this sort of epiphany that as long as your faith was perfect, your devotion to Jesus, your devotion to God, was absolute and complete, and you threw yourself on the mercy of God, then God would forgive you, and you didn't need some priest to make you recite prayers, or you didn't need to buy indulgences. So this for him was an aha moment, and he wanted to tell everyone. He also wanted to reform the church, that the church actually let people know that this was possible. The church claimed that works, i.e. actions, brought salvation, was exactly against this idea. So Luther claimed that faith was what was necessary, and he also combined this with the doctrine of predestination. Only God knows who will be saved and who will be damned, and humans don't know, and they don't have authority over this at all. And neither good works or faith alone guaranteed salvation. God decides who gets salvation. Everything depends on the grace of God. And he also asserted that the ultimate source of authority in religion was the Bible and not the church. And these ideas were heretical in the Catholic Church, you can imagine. And of course, they undermined the church's position. If the church was no longer in control of the key to salvation, which was in the sacraments administered by the church or the actions prescribed by the church, if it depended on an individual and their particular position with God, their attitude to faith and trust, and it depended on God's grace in forgiving this person or not forgiving the person, then you didn't need the church anymore to achieve salvation. You could do it by yourself if you had the correct spiritual attitude. And we'll just look at a text that Luther wrote on that. Let's go to that next page. So here is Luther being rude about church and the papacy. First, you know that under the papacy, it is not only taught that the saints in heaven intercede for us, even though we cannot know this, as the scripture does not tell us such, but the saints have been made into gods, and that they are to be our patrons to whom we should call. Some of them have never existed. It's very true. St. George, for instance, probably never existed. To each of these saints, a particular power and might has been given, one over fire, another over water, another over pestilence, fever, and all sorts of plagues. Indeed, God must have been altogether idle to have let the saints work in his place. Luther was very good on sarcasm. But this atrocity, the papists themselves are aware, as they quietly take up their pipes and preen and print themselves over this doctrine of the intercession of the saints. I will leave this subject for now, but you can count on my not forgetting it and allowing this primping and preening to continue without cost. Luther was always a great polemicist. He liked it. He liked a fight. He really did enjoy a fight. I'll just pause here because I can see the various messages in the chat. Some of the church need a new reformation. Depends which church you're talking about. A lot of Catholics would like a new reformation to purge the things. I thought Jesus was the Messiah to remove sin. Yes, but the church had arrogated that power to itself. Is there any evidence Columbus was Jewish? I don't know. How did Luther differ from Calvin? We're getting on to that. And there's a long thing about, okay, well, we're off the converts now, so I'll leave that one, but that's very interesting to look at that. Okay, so Luther rapidly gained followers, eager to join what they perceived as an alternative to the Catholic Church. One element in this rapid spread of his ideas was, of course, the newly invented press, the printing press. It was by now quite cheap to print and distribute pamphlets about what you wanted to say. It was a very efficient way. Think internet. It was a really efficient way to get your message out to people. You didn't have to go around preaching in person. You could just get these pamphlets done. People would carry them around, and boom, before you knew it, you had hundreds of thousands of followers. Luther was told to recant his ideas by the church authorities. He refused. He was excommunicated in 1521. Now, that was a big deal. It meant he was now outside the law. Nobody could legally give him food or help him, and he could be killed with no legal consequences at all. But there was a local ruler who was sympathetic to his ideas, and he hid Luther in his castle for several years. Luther spent the time translating the New Testament into German. And that, of course, was printed. He eventually translated the entire Bible, and he continued to write about his new vision of Christianity. And in an early work, surprisingly, given his later career, he was quite nice towards Jews in some of his early works. So there was a book entitled That Jesus Christ Was Born a Jew, which not everyone at the time would have agreed with, but he was promoting this. So he was quite positive about Judaism in this particular book because he hoped that the Jews would join his new movement. Now that Christianity has been purged of its errors, obviously the Jews will join up. That was what was stopping them before. However, the Jews didn't see it that way. They did not convert. And Luther turned against Jews and wrote the notorious book On the Jews and Their Lies, in which he describes the Jews as a base whoring people and recommends burning down synagogues, destroying Sidurim, and perhaps even advocates murder. He certainly writes, "We are at fault in not slaying them." So Luther has an appalling anti-Semitic reputation, quite justly, which the Lutheran Church has sort of semi-come to terms with, but you know they haven't stopped calling it the Lutheran Church. So somebody else about Calvin, there were other leaders. So first of all, Ulrich Zwingli, who died in 1531, he was in Switzerland, and there he formed an alliance of reformed cantons who fought against the Catholic cantons of Switzerland. Zwingli actually died in one of the battles, and the Swiss Reformed Church regards him as their founder. Even more notable was John Calvin, or Jean Calvin is what he was really, he's French, born in 1509, died in 1564, so a little bit later than Luther. Though he overlapped with him. And he represents, if you like, the second wave of the Reformation. He was influenced by Luther, but he took his ideas even further. He'd studied in Paris, but he renounced his Catholicism there in 1533, and he settled in Basel. And there he began to write his great work, The Institutes of the Christian Religion, which are still read in certain Protestant circles. He laid great emphasis on the doctrine of predestination. He said that there was no such thing as free will. People, you know, people couldn't save themselves at all. People could only be saved if God had already decided they would be saved. He was invited to Geneva by sympathizers, and he instituted a very, very austere and disciplined lifestyle for the citizens of Geneva. It was a sort of a terrible religious republic that was probably equaled anything under the Taliban. And it was full of hard, sober labor and no worldly pleasures at all. So we're going to do a little bit of Calvin, to get a little bit of his flavor. So this is from his The Necessity of Reforming the Church from 1543. He writes, "First, in regard to the sacraments, ceremonies devised by men were placed in the same rank with the mysteries instituted by Christ. The seven sacraments were received without any distinction, though Christ appointed two only, which would be baptism and the Eucharist, or Holy Communion, or Mass, the transformation of the bread and the bread and wine. But there were, of course, other sacraments, like confession was a sacrament, marriage was a sacrament, the ordination of priests was a sacrament, and these were not accepted by Calvin and Protestants like him. The others are resting merely on human authority. Yet to these, the grace of God was held to be annexed just as much as if Christ had been present in them. So they're fake sacraments. Moreover, the two sacraments which Christ instituted were fearfully corrupted. Baptism was so disguised by superfluous additions that scarcely a vestige of pure and genuine baptism could be traced, while the Holy Supper, this is the Eucharist or Communion, was not only corrupted by extraneous observances, but its very form was altogether changed. What Christ commanded to be done and in what order is perfectly clear. But in contempt of his command, a theatrical exhibition was got up and substituted for the supper. For what resemblance is there between the Mass, the Catholic version, and the true supper of our Lord? While the command of Christ enjoins believers to communicate with each other in the sacred symbols of his body and blood, the thing seen at the Mass ought more properly to be termed excommunion. For the priest separates himself from the rest of the assembly, and devours apart that which ought to have been brought forward into the midst and distributed. And this refers to the Catholic practice, which was that you could go to communion, but you didn't take communion, you didn't actually eat the bread and the wine, usually, except maybe twice a year at very, very important occasions. And very often the wine was not given to the ordinary believers, only the bread, for fear they might spill it or mess it up. So usually the priest was the only person who actually consumed these sacred items, and full communion was withheld from the bulk of the population. And Calvin is saying, no, it's meant to be for everybody. Then, as if he were some successor of Aaron, the priest pretends that he offers a sacrifice to expiate the sins of the people. It's not that at all, says Calvin. So he completely, completely disagreed with this interpretation of the Catholic Church. He also introduced an idea of somebody being called. So he felt that some men and women seemed ill-fitted for ordinary life. They were avaricious and slothful and amoral, but there were others who seemed to be very happy and accomplished much and in the right spirit. So they must have been called by God. for particular functions here on earth. So if you wake up early and you work at your calling and you're thrifty and sober and you abstain from frivolity, there is an unintended consequence, which is that you probably become wealthy because you're working very hard. So Calvin didn't actually invent capitalism or free enterprise or the desire for wealth, but he rationalized that desire by arguing that certain people are imbued with the spirit of acquisition and the correct spirit. And this is where the Protestant work ethic comes from. Your piety can be measured by your success. If you work hard and God favors you, you're obviously in tune with God. And you can see that in quite a lot of Protestant denominations to this day. I think some of the Christian groups gaining huge following in China, for example, are very much based on this idea that, you know, if you're successful, obviously you're doing what God wants. So again, Calvinism didn't invent this idea that your worldly success proves that you are the favored of God, but it certainly lent a lot of support to that idea when it turned up. So while Lutheranism spread very widely in Germany and Scandinavia, which is still the heartland of Lutheranism, particularly in areas where the local ruler thought that adopting this new religion would be to his personal advantage, which often was because then they were independent of Rome, Calvinism made inroads elsewhere in Europe. In general, Calvin produced a really efficient organization unmatched by any other Protestant group at the time. And his institutes spelled out faith and practices in very fine detail, with a tight discipline within every Calvinist cell, or synod, as it was called, and that held the entire system together. And Calvinist ministers traveled throughout Europe, gaining new adherents and organizing them into new cells. And from the city of Geneva flowed an endless wave of Calvinist propaganda, pamphlets, books, sermons, and the whole point was to educate Calvinist congregations and increase the membership. And by 1564, when Calvin died, there were more than a million French Calvinists, also known as Huguenots. You may know that word. That was a sort of a particular word about France, but it's essentially Huguenots are French Calvinists. Scotland had been won over to Calvinism, and the religion also found a home in England, the Low Countries, i.e. Netherlands, Belgium, and Hungary, rather surprisingly. In England, things were a little bit odd because of the personal history of King Henry VIII. And at first, when England split with Rome, that was because Henry VIII wanted a divorce. It was not because of Henry VIII's religious principles. He wanted the same old church he'd ever had, but he wanted to control it, and he didn't want the Pope to say, no, you can't get divorced. So very conveniently, when the Pope refused to grant him a divorce from Catherine of Aragon, he declared himself head of the English church and said the Pope had no authority over it. This was 1536. Now, Henry himself was really against Luther. He'd written a little pamphlet against Luther and the new reforming ideas, and he tried to stamp them out. And the Pope had rewarded them, this was a bit earlier on, with the title of Defender of the Faith, Fide Defensor, which still appears in the title of the monarch in the UK. It's on the coins. It said Fid Def. That's Fide Defensor. And that is a Pope conferred title, which Henry hung on to after he declared himself independent of the Pope. And he didn't really want anyone reforming the religion. He just wanted things to be as they were before. But because he had cut off England from the authority of the Pope, it made it much easier for his successors, or was it successors' advisors, to introduce much more extreme reformer ideas. And that really, really changed the character of the English church, especially under the next king, Edward VI, who reigned 1547 to 1553. And there were some very strong local Protestant aspirants like William Tyndale, who was a really strong reformer. He translated the Bible into English. He had to go abroad. He was hunted down by agents of the Holy Roman Emperor and executed for heresy in 1536. And the Tyndale New Testament was printed and widely distributed, but it was so hated by the authorities that only three examples have actually survived physically. I have seen one of them in the British Library, so that's quite interesting. So if we step back and we look at Protestantism as a whole, what are the main features? Very much focused on individual study of the Bible. The great slogan was sola scriptura, only the scripture as a source of authority. Insistence on giving communion in what are called two kinds, i.e. bread and wine, to everybody. Different views of what that bread and wine was for the Catholics. mystical process called transubstantiation happens, in which the bread and the wine actually become the body and blood of Jesus. Don't ask me how, I have no idea. Protestants said, no, that they don't become actual Jesus. How could they? They are symbols reminding us of the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, but they're just bread and wine. So they're more laid back about it. The sacraments were usually reduced just down to the basic two, baptism and communion. There was less ritual. They didn't like statues in many, many places. Statues were attacked or destroyed, and all around England to this day, there are empty niches in cathedrals where medieval statues of saints were destroyed or had their heads knocked off. You can see that in the Netherlands too. And far fewer pictures, no incense, no special vestments for priests. All of the ritual that had developed over the centuries was thrown out. It was a much less centralized set of churches. Very often, there were multiple church organizations, very often independent congregations decided rather generally how to run themselves rather than going to some sort of head honcho in the middle. And there was an emphasis on personal faith and salvation. And churches dating from this early period are usually called Lutheran or Reformed. You'll come across things say Reformed Church of wherever and Lutheran Church wherever. So they are usually churches that date from this period. Now, a byproduct of this, because the authority had been taken far away from central authorities and very much given to individuals, was the development of religious toleration. It wasn't an ideal. It was just, well, you know, if you read the Bible one way and somebody down the street reads the Bible another way, you're probably going to have to get on to it because you can't say, well, I have more authority than you do. So especially in the Netherlands, religious toleration became a thing, which is why Jews who had converted in Spain and wanted to come out went to the Netherlands, because you wouldn't be attacked, because there was toleration, not enthusiasm. None of the Protestants thought the Jews were a good thing, but they weren't going to kill them, or they weren't going to attack them, and they weren't going to throw them out, and they weren't going to tell them they couldn't be Jews. They didn't care. They'd escaped from Catholic Spain. Fine. They wanted to be Jews. That was their business. Nobody was going to mess with them. So the Netherlands in particular became a haven for Jews who wanted to return to their religion. Now, of course, the Catholic Church didn't take any of this lying down, and they reacted to the new movement, and they rejected the innovations and reinterpretations of doctrine introduced by the reformers. They did realize they were going to have to clear up their act, particularly about the corruption. So you get the Counter-Reformation. And they did start reforming abuses, promoting new and more spiritual movements. And the very famous Council of Trent, which was in session from 1545 to 1563, upheld the original doctrine that you would be saved both by works, what you did, and faith. And they upheld transubstantiation in the matter of the bread and wine in the communion service. They upheld the validity of all seven sacraments, and all the practices like venerating Mary and the saints and pilgrimages and so on. But they also added measures to improve church discipline, church administration, rooting out corruption, education of priests, who very often were very illiterate and knew the Mass off by heart or bits of it off by heart, but didn't know anything else. And they founded a lot of new religious orders with specific tasks. So, for instance, the Jesuit order was founded at 1533 by a Spanish nobleman and ex-soldier called Ignatius of Loyola. And that was an order that was organized along military lines. And they were involved in education, missionizing work, especially in Asia and America. It was the Jesuits who went to Japan and trying to convert the Japanese. And they were very active in South America too. And they were often confessors, i.e. spiritual advisors to kings and statesmen. So they had a lot of political power. They were also very conscious of fighting against the wicked reformers, who they saw as total heretics. And we'll have a little look at something that Ignatius of Loyola wrote here. So this is the Catholic reaction. The heretics, by which he means the reformers, or eventually they become known as Protestants because they protest, have made their false theology popular and presented it in a way that is within the capacity of the common people. They preach it to the people and teach it in the schools and scatter pamphlets that can be bought and understood by many. They influence people by their writings when they cannot reach them by preaching. Their success is largely due to the negligence of those who should have shown some interest, and the bad example and the ignorance of Catholics, especially the clergy, have made such ravages in the vineyard of the Lord. Hence, it would seem that our society, Jesuits, should use the following means to end and cure the evils which the church has suffered through these heretics. They're saying they're heretics, but they're really good on spreading their ideas. They have got the whole advertising and marketing stuff down pat, and we should use their techniques and counter their propaganda. They are sending out cheap pamphlets. We should do that. So they are using the enemy's methods to fight that enemy, and that becomes a big thing in the Catholic world. It hadn't been before, where it was, who cares? You don't care about the ordinary people. And there were other reforms too. So, for instance, Teresa of Avila, a Spanish nun who was born in 1515 and died in 1582, reformed the Order of the Carmelites, which is an order of nuns, and wrote very influential mystical works. Interestingly, her paternal grandfather was a forced convert in 1492, and he was later accused of returning to Judaism. Didn't deter Teresa of Avila, who became a very firm nun. And there were also other things. For instance, the Council of Trent directed artists and musicians working in the service of the church to produce simpler works, more spiritual works. And you get a trend in Catholic art at the time where you have the sort of painting that shows something you can meditate on. Elijah receiving food from the ravens, for instance, or a saint in agony. And you were meant to contemplate these pictures as an aid to spiritual development. Ignatius Loyola wrote a series of spiritual exercises that people could do to improve their faith. So there's a whole emphasis on spirituality that maybe hadn't been quite there in this sort of mass communications way before. So this was a new development and very much in reaction. So the Counter-Reformation is a reactionary movement against the Reformation, but the Reformation has this vast amount of influence over Catholicism too, rather surprisingly. So I'm just looking at this. I'm going to ignore the conversion questions because we sort of found that bit. How many average people picked their own Christianity as opposed to being whatever your ruler was? Not if you were sensible. If you didn't want to get stuck in prison or stopped from this or thrown out of your job, you were the religion your ruler was. If you wanted to maintain your own religion, you'd better move somewhere else. So there was a certain amount of moving around. Germany was a patchwork of dukedoms and bishoprics and things. You know, there were about 300 local rulers. And if your local one went the way you didn't want, if you could, you probably picked up your traps, because otherwise you would be living very much as a second-class citizen. But no, you couldn't just... You could maintain your own religion in defiance of the local ruler, but it came at a price. And, you know, you'd have had to be quite economically, shall we say, secure to pay that price, probably. Okay, so from the Reformation onwards, things get madly complicated in the Protestant world. In contrast to the older churches like the Roman Catholic Church, which is still the Roman Catholic Church, or the Eastern Orthodox churches, which are what they were, the Protestant world saw the formation of more and more and more and more different denominations and different churches, and different movements, and they themselves split into new groupings. We'll just have a very quick look at Britain. Just to give you an idea, it's been estimated there are 1,200 different Protestant denominations in the United States. So the Protestantism, because it's based very much on individual authority and individual interpretation of the Bible, means that people split all the time. Like, you know, I don't agree with you, I'm going to found my own church. And they do. So what happened in England? That was quite interesting in some ways because of this involvement with the political process with Henry VIII. The movement known as Puritans, which was a little nickname for them, shapes up in Edward VI's reign after Henry VIII. And it was very, very Calvinist, that they wanted a more decentralized system than the Church of England was at the time. They called it Presbyterian, after presbytos, which means an elder. They wanted a church governed by elders, not with an archbishop and bishops and this pyramid structure. They wanted a much more flat structure. And they objected to parts of the official Book of Common Prayer that had been issued under Edward VI. They didn't agree with it. It wasn't radical enough. They wanted away with the images, away with priestly vestments, away with all sorts of ritual things. They were far more radical than the official Church of England. But most of them stayed in and were just a very radical wing. The radical people were much more successful in Scotland, where they did impose far more Calvinist ideas. And Presbyterianism started first in Scotland, where Calvin was so influential. It's based on the idea, again, that it should be a council of elders, not one single person governing a church. No bishops, no pope, elders. The main person there was John Knox, who had studied with Calvin, returned to Scotland and reformed the Church of Scotland, which, of course, at the time was a separate kingdom, along Presbyterian principles. And Presbyterianism in England didn't do so well. It was sort of secretly established in 1572, but it was only legal from 1647. You could actually call yourself a Presbyterian and organize a congregation. And some of the Puritans wanted literally a completely independent system of every congregation ruled itself and was accountable to nobody at all, called congregationalism. You may have heard of congregational churches. And an endless array of groups and sects existed at this time, which is quite illustrative of how Protestantism developed everywhere. You had sects called Seekers, Ranters, Antinomians, Soul Sleepers, Adamites, Diggers, Levellers, Anti-Baptists, Baymanists, Muggletonians, and there were many, many others. So basically, you know, under every rock, there was yet another Protestant sect. And there was quite a lot of religious experimental when the head of King Charles I was chopped off in 1649, and England was ruled for 12 years by Oliver Cromwell, what's known as the time of the Protectorate or the Interregnum. And that's exactly the time the Jews came back to England too. That period of experimentation ended with the return of the kings, with Charles II, and the Church of England took over again. And many of the more extreme Protestants got thrown out of the Church of England because they wouldn't accept various basic rules. About 1,760 ministers wouldn't accept the 39 articles of the faith of the Church of England and lost their jobs. And from now on, Protestants in Britain were divided into Anglicans, members of the Church of England, and dissenters or nonconformists who usually occupied a secondary position. And that's people like, still around some really, Quakers and people like that, who were illegal originally. I see we haven't got much time, so I'm going to skip the Methodists and the Quakers, so they were very interesting. What I want to do is look again at the opportunities Protestantism gave to the Jews. And you may know the name of Manasseh ben Israel. Manasseh ben Israel was a Jew from a converso background in Amsterdam, and he, you can see his dates there, he petitioned Oliver Cromwell during the interregnum to let the Jews back into England. They had been expelled in 1290, and there'd been no official Jewish presence in England since 1290. And the interesting thing, if you look at a bit of this, we won't read all of it because there's too much here, this is only an extract, he sent a humble address, which was printed as a pamphlet, to Oliver Cromwell saying, please let us back in. And he clearly knew how to work with Protestants, which is fascinating. Look at the way he uses the Bible, which would have been very important to Protestants. He says, it is a thing most certain that the great God of Israel, creator of heaven and earth, doth give and take away dominions and empires according to his own pleasure, exalting some and overthrowing others. This is literally a few years after the king's head had been chopped up. So he's saying, it's all in God's hands. Who, seeing he hath the hearts of kings in his hand, he easily moves them with whithersoever himself pleases to put into execution his divine commands. It's all by God's will. This, my lord, Cromwell, appears most evidently out of those words of Daniel, where he, rendering thanks unto God for revealing unto him that prodigious dream of Nebuchadnezzar, doth say, thou that removest kings and sets up kings. In other words, we don't blame you for chopping the king's head off. This is fine. This is all according to the Bible. And elsewhere he writes, to the end the living might know that the highest hath dominion in man's kingdom and give the same to whom he please. Of the very same mind are the Talmudists, the Talmudists likewise, affirming that a good government or governor is a heavenly gift, and that there is no governor but is first called by God unto that dignity. This they prove from that passage of Exodus, behold, I have called Bezalel by name. So what he's saying is, here you are, not a king, but that's fine. Jews have no problem with this because we see from the Bible that God can appoint and dismiss kings, and it all comes from God, and we're okay with that. And if God has appointed you as the ruler, that's fine with us. We're not going to make any fuss at all. He's using a lot of biblical texts, which the Protestants are all going to go, yeah, I'm down with that. Daniel, yes. Exodus, yes, I know that text. This man is making a good argument. Then he does a little bit more of biblical persuasion. The great examples of great monarchs make good, especially of such who have afflicted the people of Israel. For none hath ever afflicted them who hath not been by some ominous exit most heavily punished of God. Bad things happen to people who mistreat the Jews. You can see it in the Bible. As is manifest from the histories of those kings, Pharaoh, Nebuchadnezzar, Antiochus, Epiphanius, it's actually the same person, Pompey and others. Now, look at history. You'll see God is on the side of the Jews. And on the contrary, none was ever a benefactor to that people and cherished them in their countries, who thereupon hath not presently begun very much to flourish. Insomuch that the oracle to Abraham, I will bless them that bless thee and curse them that curse thee, seemeth yet daily to have its accomplishment. And good things happen, the Bible says so, to people who are nice to the Jews. You can see how he's using these biblical texts in a way that is going to convince this very Protestant ruler to say, oh, well, yes, the Bible has no problem with Jews being around, etc. And let's just go down to this paragraph. First and foremost, my intention is to try, if by God's good hand over me, I may obtain here for my nation the liberty of a free and public synagogue, wherein we may daily call upon the Lord our God. So I would like to reintroduce Jews and legal worship of Jews back into England. Then he says, my second motive is, because the opinion of many Christians and mine do concur herein, that we both believe that the restoring time of our nation into their native country is very near at hand. Christians believe, and they did, some of them, the millennial Protestants, and Jews believe that the Messiah is about to come or all go back to Israel. I believe more particularly that this restoration cannot be before these words of Daniel chapter 12, verse 7 first be accomplished, when he said, and when the dispersion of the holy people shall be completed in all places, then shall all these things be completed, signifying therewith that before all be fulfilled, the people of God must first be dispersed into all places and countries of the world. So he says, we have to get everywhere first, and then the Messiah can come. We're not in England. If you want the Messiah to come, which he knows for is Jesus coming back for Protestants, and if we want the Messiah to come, then you have to let the Jews into England, otherwise it's not going to happen. Now we know how our nation at the present is spread all about, and hath its seat and dwelling in the most flourishing parts of all the kingdoms and countries of the world, as well in America. He's aware that there are already Jews in America, this is in the 1650s, as in the other three parts thereof, except only in this considerable and mighty island, but we're not in England. And therefore this remains only in my judgment, before the Messiah come and restore our nation, that first we must have our seat here likewise. We all want the Messiah to come, let us back into England, the Messiah will come. And then he says, and it will be to your profit. My third motive is grounded on the profit that I conceive this commonwealth is to reap, if it shall vouchsafe to receive us. For thence I hope there will follow a great blessing from God upon them, and very abundant trading into and from all parts of the world. Not only without prejudice to the English nation, we're not going to take jobs, but for their profit, both in importation and exportation of goods. We will sell your products for you all around the world. We've got the networks. The fourth motive of my coming hither is my sincere affection to this commonwealth, by reason of so many worthy, learned, and pious men of this nation, whose loving kindness and piety I have experienced. The English are lovely to the Jews. Hoping to find the like affection in all the people generally, the more because I always have, both by writing and deeds, professed much inclination to this commonwealth. I've always been a supporter. And I persuade myself they will be mindful of that command of the Lord our God, who so highly recommends to all men the love of strangers, much more to those that profess their good affection to them. In other words, remember the Bible says be nice to strangers. And here is a little picture of Manasseh in Israel by his friend Rembrandt. They were good friends. They lived on the same street. So here we have an example of a Jew using Protestant sensibilities towards the Bible and the Word of God and the expectation of the second coming of Jesus, which was a big thing for many Protestants, having gone back to the New Testament, which itself often writes as though they think Jesus is coming back next Tuesday. So many Protestants thought, yes, obviously we're living in the end times. And very cleverly, Manasseh ben Israel exploits all those weak points or characteristics of a Protestant government to use them as justification for letting Jews come back to England, which is a fascinating example of this tangled history. So that's it for this week, and I hope you enjoy. I love the Manasseh ben Israel thing. It just gets me every time. He's so clever. And next week we will probably look at a particular affair that happened during just when the Reformation is kicking off, where a Catholic Hebraist, defends the Jews against the risk of having all their books destroyed throughout the Holy Roman Empire. It's a very unusual incident and is, again, a classic example of the way our histories cross backwards and forwards. So we'll do that next week. And if there are any last questions, I'm sorry we've gone 5 minutes over, but if anyone's got any last
questions. Yes, do you think that Menashe ben Israel has something to do with the fact he's in Holland? And the Puritans were in Holland when they left England and before they came to America. Is there any connection between that?
Ah, you mean the particular Puritans who went off to America in the Mayflower?
Yeah, or something. Maybe that's how he understood them, or maybe Cromwell had some connection with them, or something like that, and he could use it to appeal to Cromwell.
I think the Mayflower lot were a very small group. I'm just looking up when they went. They went in 1620, so they'd already gone. Yeah. They went 30 years plus before Menashe ben Israel made his appeal. And I imagine they didn't, you know, they're a big thing in America now because, you know, they were the first who went over. Though there had been colonists before, but they're a big deal. I think at the time they were pretty invisible in Britain. There's another load of extreme, mad, radical, crazy Protestants were getting themselves out of the country, and probably the majority of English Protestants were going, thank God they've gone. Terrible, judgmental people they are. And, you know, once they did go in get to America, you know, where they proudly proclaimed they were now free to worship, one of the first things they did was, you know, persecute anyone who didn't agree with them. So, yes, they weren't very lovely people. Many Protestants were very happy to turn around and persecute other Christians who didn't agree. But it looks to me as it's 30 years too early. So I don't think that, and I don't know that Menashe ben Israel would have known about the Mayflower. As I say, it was a small and obscure group. I don't think the departure of the Mayflower made much of an impression on the British, or the English it would have been at the time. Alas, no. But many of the ideas of Protestants did, because they read the Old Testament, you know, for them, the Old Testament, Tanakh for us, because they were deeply familiar with it in a way that Catholics weren't particularly. Catholics were not terribly encouraged to, you know, it wasn't a big thing if they were going to read something. And again, reading the Bible is not such a big thing for Catholics. But if they were, they began to read the New Testament. They began to interpret it according to the church's authorized interpretation. Whereas, you know, the Protestants got into it and did their own interpretations and sometimes coincided with Jewish interpretations in many ways. So felt much more connected to Jews. And actually, you get a lot of Protestants at this time writing themselves into the Jewish story. And again, seeing themselves as the new Israel, but not so much in the way the early Christian church did, where it was, we are the new Israel, you have lost all right to your scriptures. It was much more, look, this story about coming out of Egypt from the oppressive king, read Catholic Church, really resonates with us. And the Jews had that story too. And, you know, we are brothers. We are proper biblically bound people. And we may think the Jews are wrong, but we certainly don't want to burn them or kill them, because we believe in religious toleration, not appreciation, but toleration. You can't kill people for that. You can kill people for the wrong idea of Christian doctrine, yes, but, you know, not Jews necessarily. So it's this odd sort of slightly contradictory thing, but the mutual interest in the Bible really made many Protestants sort of pro-Jewish in to a certain extent. You know, we recovered our status as people of the Bible, so worthy of respect, even completely wrong about Jesus, but still people of the Bible. So that worked, as we've seen, often in our favour. And I have to say, Menashe ben Israel was a clever man. He knew exactly what he was doing. He'd done a lot of research. He knew what would move Cromwell. Interestingly, it was never done officially. There was never any formal legal readmission of the Jews to England. They just weren't stopped, and, you know, nothing was said in a very English way. It was muddled through, and Jews turned up, and everyone went, oh, it's okay, we don't care. And are still in England. But there's never actually been any official confirmation. It was just a sort of quiet, passive, we won't throw them out again. Which is quite interesting. Any other questions?
Weren't Catholics discriminated against in England? They had a kind of high...
Horrifically, yes.
Jews.
Yes, under Edward VI and under Elizabeth, yes, you at certain periods you could be fined if you didn't turn up at Protestant church. were Catholic families who paid fines every week. Priests were sent, Catholic English seminaries were established on the continent in Belgium and elsewhere, and sent over secret priests disguised, because of course, you know, they had to administer the sacraments. So they would pretend they were merchants, and if they were caught, they were killed, beheaded and tortured and what have you. And there are still many old English houses, usually nobles' houses, which have hiding holes for priests. And so they were horrendously persecuted. Then Mary became queen. She was Catholic. She tried to reverse it, and all the Protestants were, you know, about 300 Protestants were burnt at the stake during her reign. And then the next monarch was Protestant. It all swung back again. So yes, it was a pretty nasty situation. The Jews were keeping their heads. Well, the Jews came back after Mary, so it was a Protestant atmosphere. And they just kept their heads down and shut up about things and just didn't make any trouble for anyone. There probably only were a few hundred Jews all in London. So, yes, they definitely managed to ride the tides. Catholics were under major disabilities till about 1870. They weren't allowed to go to Oxford and Cambridge. They weren't allowed to do all sorts of things. And I think that the bars, certainly on Cambridge and Oxford, were removed for Jews and Catholics at the same time. So there was a lot. There were anti-Catholic riots, and the Catholic aristocracy, you know, preserved the faith, but it took a long time for British Protestants to be not so suspicious of Catholics. And the remnant of that you can still see in Northern Ireland, where feelings are still high about Catholics and Protestants. I think most of the Brits nowadays don't care tuppence. Brideshead Revisited, yes, Catholic. Evelyn Waugh, the author, was a Protestant who converted to Catholicism and became very missionizing. So that's why
what was Wales? If Ireland was mostly Catholic except for Northern Ireland and it's Presbyterian in Scotland, what was Wales?
Wales became very Methodist. Particularly the Methodists had a huge success in Wales. And Wales tends to be rather austerely Methodist and chapel. In often towns there was a church, which is Church of England, and a chapel, which was Methodist. But most of the working class Welsh are dissenters. They are not Anglicans. So they, you know, there are some Anglicans in Wales, but characteristically people tended to be chapel and were non-conformists. That was the dissenters or non-conformists was the term for people like Methodists and Quakers. And Quakers had a terrible time too. And yes, it's a complicated situation. But as England gets less and less religious, and for the first time, the last census showed that fewer than 50% of the population now define themselves as Christian. Most of them just define themselves as nothing in particular. So as the English get more and more secular, the Catholic Protestant wars have died down enormously. Though you will still find high feeling on both sides. And then English Catholics still sort of keep their heads a little bit down, you know, and every now and then it flares up. So, you know, I think there's still something that says that the monarch definitely can't be Catholic. Right? The monarch can't marry a Catholic. So there are some reserves where people are a little bit. And when Tony Blair was prime minister, his wife was Catholic. But he very carefully did not convert to Catholicism until after he stopped being prime minister, because it would have certainly raised a huge row in Northern Ireland. So there are still traces of the anti-Catholic feeling. Yes, the anti-papist feeling. Dissenters equal Magdim. Linguistically, yes. Religiously, no. So, you know, to dissent means to not to agree with something, which is Lihid Naged, to oppose. So on a linguistic thing, yes. Yes. But they're not like the Magdim in the Jewish world. Very different. Okay. Righty-ho. We're 40 minutes past. We should probably go. Any last really urgent questions that I can answer quickly?
Could I ask a question? How does the Moravian fit into all of this? Are they just part of the Protestants or?
The Moravian Brethren are a Protestant sect. I don't know much about their history, but there were a lot, particularly around Hungary and what used to be Czechoslovakia. There were several Protestant movements and Protestant heroes. Jan Hus is very famous in the Czech Republic still, who spearled Protestant movements very often were fought against. There were huge wars of religion that I haven't gone into at all in the 17th century in Europe generally. There were a lot of Catholics fighting Protestants and Protestants fighting Catholics. And there was the Seven Years' War is an example of a huge religion-based sort of huge war that covered most of Europe, which was ended, I think, in 1648 at the Peace of Westphalia. But there was a lot of fighting along denominational grounds. The Moravian Brethren come out of that background. Also, people like the Mennonites, very often they travel to the New World because they could practice their particular version of Protestantism in peace and quiet without being dumped on by the local rulers, who were either your higher church or Lutheran didn't approve of them, or Catholic and definitely didn't approve of them. So this is also the period of religious migration a great deal. You also see the Huguenots being thrown out of France, a lot of them taking refuge in England, where they blended into the general population. But yeah, it's a time of very heightened tensions between religion, and the Moravian Brethren are part of that recipe. Yeah. Oh, I see somebody said, did C.S. Lewis convert? Yes, he converted from atheism to the Church of England. Letter was written at the same time as the Quakers were arriving in the States. Yes, the Quakers were horrendously persecuted and spent a lot of time in prison, and a lot of them emigrated. Yes, definitely. I'm sorry we didn't have time to do the Quakers. Maybe I think also, we'll see how we go next week. I'll see if I can squidge the Quakers in somewhere because they're interesting.
Have a good.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
See you next week, I hope.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.